All right, good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming in with us this early morning. We're going to be starting our satellite symposium on updates and innovations in non-opioid pain management strategies for breast cancer patients post-surgical intervention. Before we get into our housekeeping slides, I just wanted to let anybody know who took a picture last night at one of our photo booths that we actually framed the pictures. They'll be up there on the table before you leave. You know, just grab it, take a look, see which ones are yours, and take them home. But thank you so much on behalf of PER for coming in and participating in our satellite symposium. I'm going to get through these quickly so we can get to our programming. For our in-person attendees, I'd like to please ask that you guys engage with all of our content and our presenters, so either by asking questions or by answering our questions on the iPads in front of you. Everything that we collect data-wise is going to be completely anonymous, but it's incredibly helpful towards generating future programs and further understanding the educational gaps that we're trying to address with programs like this. As such, what we're going to be doing is, for anybody who answers all of their questions, you'll be entered into a raffle for a $50 gift card. There will be a maximum of 15 recipients and further information online. I'd like to thank our chair for helping us take care of this program and set everything up with Dr. Borgen. And I'd like to thank Pacira Biosciences for their educational grant support that allowed this program to take place. To find any CME or CE information that you may need, whether it be learning objectives regarding this program, collecting credit, or just further information, if you want to come back and go through this information again, you can find that all on our website. For our in-person attendees, each of the microphones you see set up are here only to be used by practicing HCPs. So to our industry colleagues, thank you for coming out. But due to compliancy purposes, we're not allowed to have you guys come up and ask questions. You can do that after the program if the faculty do have time. For virtual attendees, it's very simple to post any of your questions online. Simply ask a question and then press submit. And then without further ado, Dr. Borgen.
So I really admire the fact that you're here. We didn't really think about daylight savings time when we got this great idea, so thank you for getting up early. This should be a really fun session, a good way to start Sunday. There's a very busy program starting at 9 a.m. With some interesting talks and a really compelling video that we're going to show of the last few moments of a patient's life and what we can learn from that. We have something called lightning rounds where we show one slide, the key slide from every lecture throughout the last 4 days. And so that's how we finish the morning out. I also want to thank Pacira for sponsoring this event. We're going to break this morning session into three parts. And I've got my two partners, Gary Schwartz from our Department of Anesthesiology at Maimonides Medical Center. And then to his right, Joshua Feinberg, my surgical partner, also from Maimonides. And Maimonides, I'm proud to say, because of the magnitude of the opioid problem in Brooklyn, New York, we were very, very early adopters of ERAS protocols and opioid minimization, from the emergency department to inpatient care, to the Department of Surgery, across virtually every specialty. More than 10 years ago, we started opioid minimization. And so today, a lot of this is about opioids. And I'm going to start things off, let's just see here, with a survey. Okay. Simple mastectomy has a higher rate of opioid addiction and chronic use than which of the following: total knee, open chole, total hip, or all of the above? Please choose now. Okay. The non-opioids Prevent Addiction in the Nation Act, or the No Pain Act, which we're going to be talking about this morning because it has really important implications for our practices, which went into effect January 1st of this year, mandates that CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, reimburse for which of the following? FDA-approved non-opioid pain management approaches in all outpatient settings, approves it in inpatient surgical settings, or in all. So outpatient, inpatient, or all. Please choose your best answer. Okay. A small study of 14 patients treated with ICBN cryoneurolysis, which we're going to talk about this morning, for post-mastectomy pain syndrome showed a significant decrease in post-mastectomy pain for 1 month, 6 months, 12 months, or 24 months. Please choose now. Great. A 64-year-old woman presenting for mastectomy with immediate breast reconstruction has a history of poor pain control and is adamant about avoiding opioids in her treatment. Which of the following enhanced recovery after surgery society recommended intraoperative long-acting analgesic options would be the best option? Liposomal bupivacaine, oxycodone, pregabalin, or sufentanil? Please choose now. Suzetrigine is a first-in-class non-opioid analgesic for the treatment of moderate to severe acute pain in adults. It reduces pain by targeting sodium channels in the CNS, sodium channels in the peripheral nervous system, potassium channels, central nervous system, or potassium channels peripherally. Please choose now. This drug was approved at the end of January of this year. It is new. We've just started prescribing it. It is the first new non-opioid calcium channel blocker in 22 years, 21 years, something like that. Some incredible. Before participating, how confident are you in using post-surgical non-opioid pain management ranging from 1, not at all, to 6? Or 7, extremely. Please choose now. All right, thank you. So, we were hoping that the opioid crisis in the U.S. would be a thing of the past by 2025, and the reality is it's not. And I think it's hard to understand the importance of opioid minimization without some visceral sense of how the problem happened, how the crisis, how the epidemic happened, and what we can do about it going forward. And so this is a story that I both love And hate to tell, because I get acid indigestion every time I talk about this, but I don't think we can forget the events of what happened. And so I want to share the story with you, and I apologize if you've heard it before. If you haven't heard it, you know, parts of it will probably surprise you. So these are my disclosures. I do not own stock in any of the products we will be talking about or in any successful American companies, as it turns out. So I have no disclosures. The United States of America has been disproportionately affected by the opioid epidemic. This was not driven by social or economic problems. Other countries have those. It was not driven by a loss of manufacturing jobs. It was not driven by a breakdown of families, soaring rates of mental illness. The 700,000 deaths were directly attributable to two drivers: lack of responsible prescribing by a very, very small number of doctors, incredibly small number of doctors, and predatory practices by the largest supplier of these opioids. This is David Sackler and his aunt at federal hearings about the role that Purdue Pharma played in the opioid crisis. And they both, it was done on Zoom, and they both held their hand up and said, "I swear to tell the truth." And they both said, "We had no idea. We believed that we adhered to the letter and the intent of the law." And when asked, "What would you do different if you went back in time?" they said, "We got nothing. I don't know of anything I would do differently." Sort of stunning to watch these videos. Their own research that they funded made it clear what the addictive nature of these drugs were. But it was so profitable, and you'll see that in sort of a nauseating way. So we're gonna come back to the Sackler family towards the end. You've seen this graph a million times, and the deaths due to opioids paralleled the explosive sales of MS-Cotton and OxyContin in the United States. The U.S., as the wealthiest nation on earth, for the first time in the history of our nation, saw its life expectancy as a nation decline between the years 2015 and 2018, way pre-COVID, due to opioid-related deaths. During that time, 122 Americans died every day. In 2018, there were 72,000 Americans who died from drug overdose. This is now over 100,000. And as I showed before, about 750,000 American lives were lost. I remember the time when they reported that opioid deaths exceeded breast cancer deaths. I never thought we'd see that in our lifetime. But, of course, in 2014, that happened. This gentleman is important. Paul Madison was a rising star law enforcement agent in the state of California, 1939. And he was alarmed by prescribing practices for morphine and opioid analgesics. And part of what he saw was a crossover from veterinary medicines being used in humans, but most of it was just over-prescribing by doctors. Now, keep in mind, this is 1939. So he convinced the state of California to create a triplicate pad system where the doctor kept one, the patient gave two to the pharmacist, one of them got sent back to the federal agencies so that they could track who was prescribing and who was receiving the opioids. 1939. We're going to see that only five states had maintained triplicate prescribing. This is prior to e-prescribing. And those five states had very, very small opioid epidemic problems. And if the country had adopted the triplicate form system nationally, it would have potentially and potentially significantly attenuated the opioid epidemic. Russell Portnoy plays a central role in this story. He grew up in Yonkers. He did his residency at Albert Einstein in the Bronx. And he had a mentor that really taught him that pain control was incredibly important. He was part of the group that was an early proponent of what we knew back then as pain as the fifth vital sign. And he lectured extensively on the safety. Imagine, the safety of opioids. He was our director of the pain service in the early 1990s when I was working at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And he traveled the hospital confronting doctors who were under-prescribing, saying that they were bad doctors, that their patients were suffering unnecessary pain. Imagine this guy coming to your office and saying, well, we looked at your clinic, your chart records, and you're just not prescribing enough opioids. Imagine that today. So in the mid-1990s, the American Pain Society, with his help, published the concept of pain as the fifth vital sign, and he was the poster child for this. The monograph outlining what this was about was actually paid for by the opioid industry and was endorsed by the Joint Commission. So we had Joint Commission surveys. How many of you have been through a Joint Commission survey? Really sucks, right? It's painful. A colonoscopy with no anesthesia. And so they would come and cite you if you were under-prescribing opioids. Hard to imagine. So he became convinced that patients were suffering needlessly. In a 1993 New York Times review, he said, addiction and abuse are not a problem. Addiction occurs in less than 1% of all patients who ever receive them. And then he went on to say, we know who get addicted. We're smart doctors. So this is what we look for. If you have tattoos, you are at increased risk for opioid addiction. Imagine, right? You can't even make this up. And so all of this 1% business is traceable back to a single letter to the New England Journal of Medicine written by two doctors. It's five sentences. And here's what you can't read this, but here's what it said. Recently, we examined our current files to determine the incidence of narcotic addiction in, wait for it, 39,000 hospitalized patients. Although there were 11,800 patients who received narcotics, there were only four cases of well-documented addiction in patients with no history. The addiction was considered major in 1 out of 12,000 patients. And then he goes on to say what the drugs were. This is where the 1% came from. Now, this was an era of paper charts. How long do you think it would take a team to go through 39,000 medical records? I did the math. Assuming you could review a chart every 10 minutes, which would be hard, 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks, that's 6,600 hours. Do we really think that these two doctors spent 6,000 hours? And the answer is no. And the conclusion of four incidents of addiction and one major is laughable. This is cited as a New England Journal study, and it was cited over 600 times by the opioid industry saying, the New England Journal says these drugs are safe. Can you imagine building your case? It's just, has anybody got indigestion yet? So in the spring of 1991, federal meetings were held to decide whether we should make triplicate forms the law of the land. Portnoy showed up and argued passionately against this, saying that it would restrict access to opioids by patients. Restrict access. And guess what? It was killed. Only five states wound up in the long run having triplicate forms. So the blue line are the states that had triplicate prescribing, and the red line are the non-triplicate states. Had we simply gone national with triplicate prescribing back 15 years ago, we would have still had a problem, but nowhere near the problem. And Purdue Pharma took all of its sales reps out of the states that had triplicate prescribing. They said, no, we're wasting our time there. So pain didn't matter in those states. It only mattered in the states where they could make a buck. So the Sackler family has an interesting history. This is a New Yorker article that if you are interested in the history of this and you want to get a migraine headache, I would recommend that you read this article. The Sacklers are currently estimated to be, prior to the litigation, the 19th wealthiest family in America. This is the Temple of Dendur in the Metropolitan Museum in New York City, which they paid for in total. And they paid for a lot of things. So the Sacklers were doctors, and they were psychiatrists. The patriarch of the family, Arthur, trained under Dr. Ofheisen, who was trained by Sigmund Freud. Now, Arthur Sackler had no intention of having you sit on his couch to talk about your mother. Not his thing. He went straight into business because he believed that doctors were reliable resources and could sell products. Trust me, I'm your doctor. So they bought an ad agency, which you'll see played a central role in the opioid epidemic. And they started with cigarettes. More doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. Almost unbelievable. And by the way, a number of scientific articles at that time were already linking smoking to lung cancer. You had to believe that they knew it. You had to believe that this was not a mystery. And then they went to Valium. Don't you love this ad? It's scary to look at. Reduce psychic tension. And they started saying that if you're having a bad day, take Valium. If you think you might have a bad day, take Valium. If you had a bad day yesterday, take Valium. So the next step in this cycle was they bought a medical publication called the Medical Tribune. This was a biweekly newspaper that supposedly peer-reviewed evidence-based medicine and in a non-biased way presented the data in bite-sized pieces. All of the reviewers worked for the Sackler Empire. All of the authors of this worked for the Sackler Empire. There were 600,000 subscribers, 600,000. It was not ever really disclosed, the link back to the Sacklers. So the second investment, whoops, my iPad just went down. The next step in the cycle was they purchased MS Contin in the 1980s. And they immediately marketed it as, if you guys can get me another iPad up here. They immediately said it's a controlled release formula. It wasn't. In fact, there was no science to show that it was controlled release. But they marketed that the fact that it was controlled release made it safer and it made it less addictive. National data on addiction was public knowledge. So this was the initial embers of the fire of the opioid epidemic. When the patent on MS Contin was due to expire in 1990, Raymond Sackler's son Richard suggested developing oxycodone. It was a formula that they had bought from a German pharmaceutical company. The German company had made this in 1916, and thus was born OxyContin. And they made it available in a wide range of strengths, 10 all the way through 160 milligrams, for a drug that was the strongest opioid in the history of painkillers. Multiple focus groups got together and said, wait, these are addictive, these are highly addictive drugs. These ads are not correct. These articles in the Medical Tribune are not correct. You guys have an iPad for me up here? So going back to Russell Portnoy, at Memorial, 1993. Thanks, I got it. Thank you. He continued, I got it. Thank you very much. Thank you. He continued to tell the world that these drugs were safe. At that point, he had a massive research portfolio. You'll never guess who funded that research. Yeah, you're right. Purdue Pharmaceuticals funded his research. So OxyContin was approved in 1995. The package insert said, you've made a wise choice. This drug is less addictive than any other opioid painkiller out there. This was approved through the FDA. If you dig into this, at every point along the approval pathways for both of these drugs, the person from the FDA who did the approval was subsequently hired by Purdue Pharma, everyone. And they went from government salaries of $100,000 to Purdue at $600,000. Every FDA approval person went to work for the Sackler family, starting with this guy, Dr. Curtis. So here's the scam. You've got these three psychiatrists. They purchase an ad agency. They purchase a medical publication. They purchase a narcotic. And then they sell the heck out of it. And this becomes a circular business model where more sales leads to more revenue, leads to more ads, leads to more drug. They continued to market this as more potent than morphine and non-addictive. Of course, the message to doctors was very clear. Addiction is rare. There's a New England Journal article. You're going to argue with the New England Journal of Medicine? No. Opioids should be dosed to effect. And they created a syndrome for doctors who didn't prescribe, which they called opioid phobia. You damn doctors are just afraid of these opioids. When doctors said, hello, Purdue, I think my patient's addicted. They said, no, this is pseudo-addiction. You're just not dosing them. This is breakthrough pain. And they coined a medical phrase, pseudo-addiction. Look at these number of sales reps that this company had. In 2017, they had 700 sales reps traveling 45 of the 50 states. They did not travel to the triplicate form states. 700 sales reps. They were told, visit these doctors three times a week. In an average year, in 2013, these sales reps made 180,000 visits to doctors. Think about that. 180,000 visits. Did these doctors have short memories? Did they forget between Monday and Wednesday? Then, to make the final coup de grace, they created a tracking company they called IMS, which was designed to track every single prescription of oxycodone to Americans. And the reason they did this was to look at low prescribers, to look at patients who would take more. Now, they had the information. This is where the litigation gets interesting, because they knew who the pill mills were. They knew exactly who was, you know, abusing the sales. They ignored that. In fact, the quote was, In the second to last bullet point, when they were confronted about this in the legal system, they said, it's not our job to assess how well a physician practices medicine. It's not unbelievable. This is a clip from a national television ad. I don't know if you guys can you guys play this clip?
There's no question that our best, strongest pain medicines are the opioids, but these are the same drugs that have a reputation for causing addiction and other terrible things. Now, in fact, the rate of addiction amongst pain patients who are treated by doctors is much less than 1%. They don't wear out, they go on working, they do not have serious medical side effects. And so these drugs, which I repeat, are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
Unbelievable. That was a national TV ad. You can tell by the high-tech TV that that ad is on. This is a national TV ad. So then the opioid makers started lobbying. They started these ad campaigns. But they also got grassroots efforts, and I'll show you a number of us who were early critics of this were attacked on what would become social media. I'll show you one of those about me. Is it possible to play this Wingnuts social media post?
I can't tell you the number of times I've heard from women who have had their breasts removed and then were denied pain medication. And if they asked for some, then they were documented as drug seekers. And then you get Dr. Patrick Borgen here, works out of Maimonides, and he promotes Exparel as opioid sparing. But I have a question for Borgen and the other middle-aged white doctors. Why do you care what women take after they have their breasts removed? Why do you care? There's no data to support that breast surgeries were driving the opioid epidemic. There's no data to support that dental surgeries were driving the opioid epidemic. But see, there's always a kernel of truth to what they say because they're banking on people not doing extensive research. Do you know how much money this man has been paid to promote Exparel? I don't even know if he owns stock in the company. Remember, they don't speak out against opioids because they're good people. They do it because they're paid to. I can't tell you the number.
So, I got described as a middle-aged white guy. So, you know, how bad could that be? So she's paid by the opioid industry. And she makes a statement in there, I've done deep research and there's no evidence. Actually, there's 225 peer-reviewed articles that show that mastectomy has the third highest rate of opioid addiction of any surgery in America after open cholecystectomy and an orthopedic operation. 225 articles saying that there's a high rate of addiction. I testified both in New Jersey and in Albany, New York, for responsible prescribing practices, which only led these wingnuts to attack me more, and they were gonna picket Maimonides Hospital. We're in a pretty rough neighborhood. I would wish them luck with that. So the opioid makers fought. They fought back. So the final step in this was Purdue hired McKinsey consultants to help them grow the sales more. Imagine that. And McKinsey looked at who was prescribing what, and they divided the prescribers into deciles. And they took the top two or three decile, the top prescribers, and said, just focus on them. Using the COVID analogy, they are your super spreaders. That's where you will make the most. Don't waste time going to doctor's offices who only prescribe a few a week or a few a month. And so McKinsey built a battle plan, which actually wound up being about 2,000 doctors across 45 states. And Purdue then put all of their money in that small number of doctors. So again, if you go back and look at doses per capita per state in the triplicate prescribing states versus not, you can see the massive differences in comparing the non-carbon copy states to the carbon copy states. Then they created a savings card. If you use our credit card, we're going to give you a cost reduction so you can get more of these incredibly safe opioids. Now, the wheels came off of this, and patients filed legal action. There were class action lawsuits. I won't go into all of those. McKinsey wound up being fined $650 million from the U.S. Justice Department for their role in expanding the opioid crisis. Not surprisingly, crime followed opioid addiction. And when you look at heat maps of burglary, assaults, other violent crimes, they paralleled the hot spots for opioid addiction. And the Sacklers did pretty well. This is what they paid themselves, $300 million several times a year, amassing a vast, vast fortune. So the wheels came off of it. There were no criminal charges filed. A lot of civil penalties. And Purdue said, okay, we get it. We're going to stop prescribing this. They created a company called Mundi Pharma to go outside of the U.S. and to repeat this model in other countries, in Central America, South America, to just repeat the model. They were gonna get the band back together again. So the Sackler family pulled off three coups. One is the first is that they sold OxyContin and created the opioid epidemic. Secondly, they were the most philanthropic family maybe in the history of this country, given to libraries and hospitals and universities. And the third coup was keeping those two separate and making sure that people did not connect the opioid crisis to their philanthropic efforts. Most institutions have taken the Sackler name off of their facilities. Most, not all. A few still have not taken the name off. But you can see on your left, the institutions that had received money who've actually taken the Sackler name off of these facilities. So this was in three acts, and this, I'm going to wrap it up and turn this over to Dr. Feinberg. So the first act was a decision, a national decision, to not expand triplicate prescribing. That was a mistake. And I believe Dr. Portnoy, this falls at his feet. Secondly, McKinsey's plan to create super spreaders, which really turbocharged the epidemic. The third mistake was there was a trend towards crushing up the OxyContin so that it could be injected or ingested in other ways. And so they created a gummy type of vehicle that you'll see. So on your right is the new formulation, which made it much more difficult to break this down and ingest it. All that did was accelerate the crossover to fentanyl. And so this was a bad thing, not a good thing. This actually shortened, with these drugs as a gateway, it shortened the pathway to fentanyl. So there are currently 614,000 legal claims against the Sackler family. The Sacklers said, hey, our bad. We'll pay $4 billion across a decade, which eventually rose to $6 billion. That would have given every victim between $3,000 and $48,000. That still left them, by the way, with $6 billion that they walked away with. So in exchange, the Sacklers would be protected against future civil or criminal liability. And the victims were sort of happy, and the Sacklers were really happy. But the U.S. Justice Department earlier, in the middle of last year, said, wait a minute, you can't buy your way out of criminal charges. And so A young Solicitor General named Elizabeth Prelogar said the plan's release absolutely, unconditionally, irrevocably, fully, finally, and forever releases the Sacklers from every conceivable claim. Can't be. And so the U.S. Supreme Court reversed this decision. So this is still going through the court system right now. Now, the patients are not so happy about this because it does jeopardize, if this becomes a criminal event, which it could, then it would jeopardize the payments to the victims, frankly. Hard to have it both ways. So this is the Supreme Court ruling from June of last year in a 5-4 vote. Really hard to imagine this is 5-4. This might have been a 9-0. But the Supreme Court said, no, you can't really do this. So that is the background of what we're talking about this morning. And I'm sorry to drone on about it, but I think it's important that Americans understand what happened. You know, this is real. 750,000 American lives. There was a news story in Brooklyn about a young man who sold fentanyl to two people and one of them died. And he got sentenced 20 years, no parole. Probably justified. But this family killed 700,000 people, right? And so anyway, with that, I want to thank you very much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Thank you. All right. Now, the second step of this morning's program is to talk about what we've done about this in Brooklyn. And for that is my partner, Joshua Feinberg. He's the Division of Breast Surgery Research Director, our former resident and fellow. So please welcome Dr. Joshua Feinberg.
Thank you so much, Dr. Borgen. That was a great enlightenment on the history. And I think, you know, as patients hear about the history more and more, what I've been noticing is that they don't want opioids necessarily. They obviously want pain control, but they don't want to be addicted, of course. These are my disclosures, nothing relevant to today's talk. So over the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to discuss pain control across the continuum of care of our patients undergoing breast surgery. We'll review enhanced recovery after surgery, and I'll provide the current evidence-based recommendations for what should be included in these ERAS protocols. We'll also review some of the non-pharmacologic alternative approaches to pain management and addressing those patients who are in the high-risk population, those patients who really may have increased pain after surgery. Just a bit of a background on enhanced recovery after surgery. So this really started in about 2003, and it really was in the field of colorectal surgery, the goal being to reduce postoperative ileus and get patients out of bed and ambulating and get them back to their baseline state, their preoperative state. And then it was extrapolated into other fields of surgery, and now it's really become the standard of care for our patients, both in the U.S. and abroad. There are these evidence-based frameworks, there's many, and the Enhanced Recovery After Surgery Society is very good about laying out the best evidence of what should be included in these protocols. But the overarching theme is that it's really multimodal management, including regional anesthesia, and the goal being to reduce opioid utilization and, as I said, get patients back on their feet, get them back to their normal routine as soon as possible. So I'm going to break it down into several different phases of having a successful ERAS protocol, and it really starts in the preoperative phase, which itself can be broken down into three different pillars. The first one being identifying those patients who are at elevated risk for postoperative pain, educating patients in the preoperative setting and counseling them, and I can't stress the importance of this enough. And then also counseling those patients who are previously or they're already on chronic opioids and how to deal with those patients before undergoing surgery. So starting off with identifying high-risk patient populations, this is very, very multifactorial. This is a study out of MD Anderson looking at certain phenotypic factors that may kind of make you aware of a patient who will experience postoperative pain. So unlike David Portnoy's strategy of looking if they have a tattoo, that doesn't really work. It's not successful. And so these are some phenotypic factors that was found in this study. What I'll say is that it's complicated. I wouldn't say that any one of single of these factors makes you at an increased risk for postoperative pain. But taking together patients, if they're young, if they have previous opioid use, their experience during surgical procedures before, if they experience pain, taking these together, that should raise a flag that maybe they're going to warrant certain measures or increased counseling to control their pain in the postoperative period. And then, of course, as surgeons, we want to take into consideration what surgery we're doing. Are we placing drains? How many? Are we doing lumpectomy, a mastectomy, of course? Are we avoiding surgery in the axilla? You know, we've heard a lot about de-escalating surgery in terms of oncologic control and reducing morbidity. And one of the morbidity of our axillary surgery is certainly pain. So the more we can reduce that, the better for our patients. Obesity certainly does seem to be a risk factor for increased postoperative pain. This is a study done at our institution at Maimonides in Brooklyn, looking at patients who underwent lumpectomy and mastectomy without reconstruction. And we measured pain scores 1 week after surgery. And obese patients, despite undergoing the same surgery and receiving the same ERAS protocol, had higher rates of persistent pain compared to non-obese patients. So this is definitely an area that warrants further investigation. You know, we use ideal body weight to calculate anesthetic dose to avoid toxicity, of course. But maybe we're underestimating the therapeutic dose necessary to control patients' pain in these patients. They have increased surface area. And as I said, in this study, certainly the obese population had increased postoperative pain. The second pillar in the preoperative phase is preoperative education. And what you'll see just in this diagram is that really it's important to counsel patients early on the entire course of their treatment. And setting expectations is huge. So telling a patient that it's normal to have some soreness. I like to tell patients it'll feel like you did a chest workout. That it's amazing how that education early on can make them feel comfortable should they experience any of those symptoms after surgery. If you don't counsel them and educate them, they'll be nervous. You know, the second they feel a little bit of soreness, they'll think, oh, something's wrong. You get a lot of calls. They're going to want pain medication. But if you take that time to counsel patients that's extremely normal and expected, they'll understand that and they'll feel a lot more comfortable after surgery. So just that counseling and education alone is really important. It can be really helpful also if you don't yourself have the time to counsel patients on this, having a PA or NP when they're going through the surgical details with the patients and the logistics to include that in their discussion. The third aspect in the preoperative phase is identifying those patients on chronic opioid use already, because really that's an independent risk factor. You do see one of these patients, they are challenging, and so I would recommend collaborating with an addiction specialist, which can be very, very helpful. Patients receiving methadone should continue their regular dose, and then this should be divided for better targeting of the pain. If they're on an oral naltrexone, this should be discontinued 3 days prior to surgery, and if it's an extended release dose, you want to stop that at least 30 days prior to surgery. Those patients on buprenorphine, the preoperative dose reduction usually allows for the typical opioid agonist in the perioperative period. So these are just some tips for those patients who are already taking opioids. And I can't stress enough, if they do already see an addiction specialist or any pain management doctor, you want to collaborate with them. In terms of the perioperative phase, so these are some of the medications and the levels of evidence with regard to administering these medications prior to surgery. Acetaminophen certainly has the best evidence for efficacy in the preoperative period. If you compare IV versus PO, certainly PO is absolutely just as effective. No study has shown superiority to the IV dose. It certainly is more expensive. So we'll go over our protocol in a bit, but we're using oral acetaminophen, 975 milligrams in the preoperative holding area. Gabapentin, there's mixed evidence on this more recently on its efficacy. Anecdotally, we've seen increased nausea in our patients, so we've actually taken this out of routine in our protocol. It's more of a case-by-case basis. Certainly, if a patient is already taking this preoperatively, you want to continue that in the perioperative setting. Oral NSAIDs and COX-2 inhibitors definitely are effective. We don't administer it in the preoperative setting. There is some mixed evidence in terms of the risk of bleeding. Nothing definitive saying that COX-2 inhibitors increase the risk of bleeding, but we've kind of reserved these more for post-op when we've already achieved hemostasis. Opioids in the preoperative setting have never, ever been shown to be effective. There's no good evidence for giving opioids in the preoperative setting, and certainly there are detrimental effects of doing that in the postoperative setting. In terms of muscle relaxants and anxiolytics, I know our plastic surgery colleagues will use these often if a patient is having an implant just to reduce that tightness and spasms in the muscle. We like it more in the postoperative setting. I would not recommend it in the preoperative setting, but certainly postoperatively there is efficacy. So Dr. Schwartz is in his talk going to go over nerve blocks, but I just wanted to review kind of the things as surgeons, what do we do at our institution. So if a patient is undergoing a lumpectomy, we use liposomal bupivacaine mixed with either 0.25% or 0.5 bupivacaine in a 1-to-1 ratio. It's important to note that this should not be mixed with lidocaine. Lidocaine can cause the liposomes to burst, and you can get toxicity from the liposomal bupivacaine. So definitely want to dilute it so you increase the surface area where you can apply it, but do not mix with lidocaine. Really important to only inject small aliquots into the skin prior to incision, the subcutaneous tissue, the chest wall, and any drained sites. And the liposomal bupivacaine is very viscous, so you really, that's why I stress the small aliquots all over the surface area. When we're doing mastectomy, so we have the advantage of the direct visualization. So this diagram is showing intraoperative photos of PEX 1 and 2 blocks. In terms of landmarks for PEX 1, you can see you're right there. The medial pectoral bundle is a really, really good landmark. And then injecting at that level between the pectoralis major and minor muscles. That's the PEX 1. And then PEX 2, similarly between PEC minor and serratus anterior, and injecting into the fascia over the serratus anterior is definitely where we see the best results. Also along you're right there, as Dr. Candice McGuire reviewed yesterday, you can easily palpate the rib. So that's also a really, really nice ideal location to inject the Expiro. Whether it's done under ultrasound guidance by our anesthesia colleagues or us in the OR, this was looked at the University of Iowa in a randomized single-blinded trial. They compared preoperative analgesia with a PEX 2 block under ultrasound guidance versus surgeons doing it intraoperatively, and it does not seem to make a difference. It really each has its pros and cons. It's what fits your workflow. What I'll say is the pros of doing it preoperatively by anesthesiologists is you're getting longer duration of the pain control. The downside is there can be risk of bleeding, risk of infection. Obviously, we want to avoid those. And as we saw from the diagram, but the pictures before, especially when you're doing mastectomy, you have that easy access and the easy view to do these blocks, and they're not complicated. So we've gone over the preoperative, perioperative phases, and now the postoperative phase. So really, the best treatment of postoperative pain is multimodal preemptive analgesia, so the things that we've already reviewed. When we move on to postoperative pain, if you've done a good job preoperatively, they shouldn't have much, but oral acetaminophen and NSAIDs certainly are safe, effective, and do reduce opioid use. I want to reiterate, mastectomy should not be an indication for routine opioid prescription at discharge. We are absolutely not prescribing opioids after lumpectomy or mastectomy, and many of our mastectomy patients are going home the same day. Of course, our lumpectomy patients are same-day admissions. If rescue opioids are needed, it is important to use clinical judgment to avoid overprescription. And continuous wound infiltration devices have been shown to be effective. I would say these are well suited for patients where nerve blocks at your institution may not be available, and using these CWI devices are a good option. I have one slide here, just as Dr. Borgen mentioned, the new non-opioid pain medication, suzetrigine. It is the first in-class non-opioid analgesic, and it treats acute to moderate severe pain. This got approved as a result of two randomized trials looking at patients who underwent abdominoplasty and bunionectomy and had increased pain scores after those surgeries. And so this is a perfect medication. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about in patients who are post-op. It signals sodium channels in the peripheral nervous system before those signals reach the brain. And so it has no addictive properties. So as I said, I'm sure we'll hear more about this, and we can add this to our armamentarium. So we've discussed the pharmacologic approaches, but also there are non-pharmacologic approaches that really we should think about. Some of these are aromatherapy, music therapy, relaxation techniques. Definitely, we see a lot of patients undergoing acupuncture. Whether these are actually found in randomized trials to be effective, I don't know how critical that actually is, but it gives patients in this setting, because it gives patients a sense of control over their disease, and honestly, these do have efficacy depending on the patient. Anecdotally, we've certainly seen advantages to each of these approaches, especially when taken together. As I said, patients don't want to take opioids, so they're looking for other strategies. Exercise, I will say, is a tough thing to study. There's a lot of confounders whether it actually contributes to reduce pain, but it certainly is a component of ERAS protocols in getting patients back on their feet earlier. And it has, in our experience, patients, especially if they're exercising before surgery and knowing what stretches they can do after surgery, it will assist with that recovery and postoperative pain. So moving on to our ERAS protocol at our institution at Maimonides. So again, it really is, before implementing it, it's important really to meet with all team members of the team. So that's the anesthesiologist, the nursing, IT support to make sure that you have that protocol in your EMR. Right now, a lot of the time, it's our nurses in the preoperative holding area who are really driving these protocols forward. They're the ones reminding the trainees to put the order set in, to make sure the patients receive their preoperative Tylenol in the holding area. So it's very important to get everyone involved on the team. Again, the preoperative counseling is very, very important here too. In the preoperative phase, so while they're in the holding area, patients will get 975 milligrams of acetaminophen. We allow clear liquids up to 2 hours of surgery. Solids are held 6 hours prior to surgery. With regard to the gabapentin, as I said, this is moved to a case-by-case basis. Certainly, if a patient has had success with this in the past, it's a very good option, but we've removed it from our routine protocol. This is an example of the order set. As you can see, it's very, very easy for the resident to place these orders, or whoever is placing orders in your EMR. It's much easier when you take the time to get this set out ahead of time, so that it's just a couple clicks and make it as easy as possible for everyone involved. intraoperatively. So as soon as the patient is positioned, we apply a forced air warming blanket to prevent hypothermia. We have an antiemetic protocol upon induction. And then during surgery, we inject the liposomal bupivacaine in the fashion that I showed earlier. In terms of Toradol at incision, this really is surgeon and case specific. The 30 milligram dose seems to have a slight increase of hematoma. 15 milligrams seems to be safe. Again, though, it's case specific and surgeon specific. It is effective, but to be honest, a lot of the measures without the Toradol are very effective. Post-operative setting, so we want these patients eating as fast as possible, getting fluids off, getting them out of bed, ambulating. We have moved to same-day discharge for our mastectomy patients, even who undergo reconstruction. Those patients who have undergone neoadjuvant treatment, their physiologic reserve tends to not be as high as the upfront surgery patients. So they do tend to stay overnight, but not necessarily. And really setting that expectation early and telling the patient that you may not be perfect when you go home. You may have a little bit of soreness, but they honestly want to get out of the hospital, and it only helps them more to get back to their normal routine. So in conclusion, I'll say that setting patient expectations in the preoperative setting is vital. You know, educating them that a bit of soreness is completely normal. It does not mean that they have a complication. It does not mean that they need extra pain medication. Multimodal analgesia, including nerve blocks, is a critical component to a successful opioid sparing pain control regimen. Perioperative pain management must be tailored to the patient and their needs and the surgery that's being involved. If it's more extensive, more axillary surgery, that those are patients really where you want to do those PEX 1 and 2 blocks. And implementing opioid minimizing ERAS protocols is certainly feasible and effective. And if anybody would like me to share our ERAS protocol, I'm happy to do that. You know, there are several variations of these, but the components that I review that is in ours really carries the best evidence and we found to be the most effective. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Schwartz, who's going to go over some of the nerve blocks and some very helpful information for our challenging patient populations.
Thank you very much for having me. This is actually one of my favorite conferences of the year to attend. I go to a lot of anesthesia meetings, pain conferences, but it's always appreciative of our surgical and medical colleagues to appreciate that perioperative pain management. And I'm going to bump off of what Josh and Pat said earlier about why this is important. I'm going to change it up this year and not just talk about the nerve blocks. I want to talk about the No Pain Act at first, because Dr. Borgen gave a great history of the Sacklers, the opiate epidemic, and why we got here. And if you heard in one of Josh's slides, we have our first new non-opiate in class in 22 years. And part of the reason that no company has really made new medications is because they can't make a profit on it. Because opiates have gotten so cheap, I don't know if you call insurance companies all the time. I deal with it in my pain practice. I want to offer someone a cryo procedure, a nerve block. And they're like, oh, just try opiates. And then I'll ask them on the phone, oh, where could I send them to? Could I send them to your office? Oh, I don't practice. I'm just talking for the drug company. So they passed the No Pain Act in December 29, 2022 on an omnibus spending bill. And I'm not talking about the two sides of the aisle in politics, but they passed these large bills at the end of the year to fund the government and everything they want to do the next year. So this was a bipartisan bill, which is quite difficult in this current environment, and no matter what side of the aisle you're on, that passed that it mandates CMS to reimburse hospitals and ASCs, or hospitals in the HOPD setting, so your hospital outpatient setting, for 3 years. So this is for the Non-Opiate Prevention Addiction in the Nation Act, and it's to reimburse for branded non-opiates for CMS patients. And as our two colleagues over here stated, most of your surgeries are going home and they fit the criteria of the HOPD. When you look at most hospitals, about 70 to 80% of the cases will fall into their categories. And obviously, ambulatory surgery centers obviously are going home. So Medicare has to reimburse for these non-opiate treatments and has been in effect since January 1st of this year. Your pharmacy should be aware of it, but if they're not, they definitely should get on it. So the law directs CMS to make separate payment under the OPPS for these drugs between January 1st of this year up until 2027. The new payments must be separate and in addition to whatever bundled care you're getting for the surgery and every other drugs and treatments they're getting in the hospital. They cannot reduce payment for paying for this. It obviously has to be budget neutral, so they fix that out in the case over there. And I know Pacira has helped funding this, and I appreciate that. They, like a drug like that where people say liposome bupivacaine is expensive compared to different things, it gets reimbursed at the average cost plus 6%. So your hospital could potentially make money now giving the adequate care to the patients. There was a new C code for cryo devices this year, and I'll talk about cryo procedures later, that give an HOPD or an ASC an extra $255 per procedure to do these in addition. So these, some of these codes, you can talk to your pharmacist later. They have a J code and a C code, and it's a separate reimbursement on these. So the impact is, number one, it's safer pain management options. We can get new treatments like sertraline. We could do liposome bupivacaine. You could use catheters in patients. You could do cryo procedures without wondering if your hospital is going to make money. Lower risk of opiate addiction, as we've seen, it's killed 700,000 people. You have more options to treat your patients effectively, to give them the proper care. And like now, we have a new medication. That NaV1.8 inhibitor, suzetrigine, is a twice-a-day medication for post-operative pain management. And I know the company is currently approved by Medicare and giving coupon codes for commercial insurance and Medicaid to get it out there. The original studies of that drug were on bunionectomies and abdominoplasties, and people always ask, oh, why do they choose those studies? It's because the FDA mandates it. When you try to have a new drug or a pain procedure, they have certain studies that you have to do. I'm kind of excited to see how it works in the real world. It's pretty exciting to have a new medication. The only limitation of it is that it interacts with the CYP450 system, so your erythromycin, grapefruit juice, drugs of that ilk, you have to be a little bit careful about, but now people can prescribe it, so I believe everyone's excited for the real-world data. And this type of act and Congress recognizing the opiate epidemic allows care like this and new treatments to come along for our patients. So for healthcare providers, number one, we have options. You could update your EROS protocols, different multimodal treatments, more treatments for patients. Let's say we have a lot of patients sometimes that might have an NSAID allergy, or some surgeons do not want to give NSAIDs after surgery. Lower risk in breast, but a lot in colorectal, a lot in spine surgery. They don't want people to have anti-inflammatories after. So these are other options, and it's financial incentives for hospital systems to have this or your ASC. Fewer opiate prescriptions, lower addiction rates. You heard it already before from Dr. Borgen. Some of these high-dose opiate patients eventually went to the fentanyl heroin route, and that where they overdosed. When I was a fellow at a prominent New York City hospital about 15 years ago, I had a patient come in, a surgeon asked, because I was rounding on the pain service on a weekend, oh, could my patient snort his oxycodone? And this was a prominent surgeon. I said, absolutely not. I told my attending, I'll quit my fellowship right now if you make me write this order. I'll just leave. And the surgeon wrote the order, patient okay to snort oxycodone in the hospital, which was ridiculous. So less hospital visits, less complications, and hopefully saves money for opiate misuse costs. These are the drugs, sorry about the slide, that are currently approved in this. Pumps, there's Exparel, there's ZynRelief. I have to give credit to the Pacira team over here because they did a lot of the brunt work on this, especially on their communications team back end with Congress. But it does, obviously it affects their company, but any drug or device that could show opiate reduction will be covered under this act for the next 3 years. So,
is it both inpatient and outpatient?
So inpatient in the HOPD setting, so inpatient, not inpatient, so in the hospital, a hospital HOPD or the ASC. So meaning a mastectomy who's going home would be an outpatient HOPD case, even though it's done in a hospital. A lumpectomy in the hospital, HOPD, would still count. So there, if it's like a trauma surge, a trauma, let's say, or a big cancer whack that you know is going to stay 7 days, will not be covered by this. But in our hospital settings, about 80% of the cases will be under the HOPD outpatient codes. So a simple mastectomy, a bilateral mastectomy, your lumpectomy. For me, I do a lot of orthopedic anesthesia and pain block. A total knee arthroplasty will get covered in this because it's a qualified code that could go home the same day. Thank you. That was a great question to qualify that. And while I open this up after, I'm going to transition now to cryo because I spoke a lot about nerve blocks over the years, and your teams could give nerve blocks. We can give them under ultrasound. But what's the next step? We've got really good at giving liposome bupivacaine, local blocks. But I think cryo is the next step, and there's a long history of it. The first time cryoneurolysis was used in the 1960s, but it was a big device. It wasn't cost effective. And over the years, these devices have gotten smaller. The treatment times have gotten shorter. And now with the advent of ultrasound and handheld ultrasounds, it allows more people to do this procedure to give longer lasting pain relief. Because our local anesthetics might last a couple of hours, liposome, bupivacaine, you got about 72 to 96. But what happens after to these patients? Because sometimes surgical healing takes longer than that. So back from anatomy, I know this is early in the morning on a daylight savings times, we know the intercostal nerves play a large role in this. So the ventral rami of the thoracic nerve roots, there's 11 of them. And each intercostal nerve runs in the intercostal space next to the vessels, and these wrap around the chest wall and are a large area of the pain relief that we're looking to block in these patients. So you could freeze these nerves because you could routinely find them under ultrasound, or our thoracic surgical colleagues could find them under live visualization. And people have been doing a lot of research to find out how long the pain relief is going to be and what we could offer our patients. So this was a study over here. This was an ultrasound-guided percutaneous nerve blocks, and they had 60 patients undergoing elective mastectomy. And they were going to get an active percutaneous cryo or a sham. And the primary component was pain over 24 hours in a couple of days. And they've noticed, and they've tracked these patients up to a year. And they noticed lower postoperative opiate consumption and pain severity scores several time points out, 3 months, 6 months, up to a year after. Phantom breast pain, which I believe you guys see a decent amount in your practice, was 10 to 20% in the sham group at various times, but there was none in the cryoneurolysis group. Chronic pain in the sham group was about 18%, which is still pretty high, but as we've heard about before, mastectomy is one of the highest with post-mastectomy syndrome. Only 3% with cryo. Obviously, the study is small. It's 60 patients, but people are looking at it, and it's a good place to start. This is what I'm looking to target when I do my nerve block. You see the cryo needle over there next to the rib. You kind of walk off the rib because you cannot always see the vessel or the nerve, and you pop through the innermost intercostal muscle, and that's the ultrasound image to the right. And that's where it will lay on the rib. It's actually fairly tolerated by patients. You give some local anesthetic by the nerve at first or on the rib, an intercostal nerve block, and then you give about a minute, minute and a half treatment of the cryo to stun the nerve. It doesn't destroy it completely. The nerve grows back. So as I mentioned before, modern cryoneurolysis has been ongoing since the 1970s. We've tried burning these nerves with radiofrequency ablation, but then we have the issue of neuropathic pain. As these devices have gotten smaller and we could target the ice balls, you don't have that neuropathic pain either, and we know that the patients do well after it. So it's very, very common now. We do it in abdominal patients. A lot of times you see it in burn units for skin grafts for a long time. Bless you. I do an orthopedic surgery a lot for total knee arthroplasty to recover, and I've done it for some post-mastectomy patients. And actually, I've started doing a lot of rib fracture patients in my practice who have trouble getting out of the hospital. It's fairly easy to use. This is just another position. The positioning of the patient, they could be either supine, prone, or just sitting up. It's been effective in phantom limb pain, neuralgias, malignancy pain. And the goal is to induce a Sunderland grade 2 lesion. So it axiomatosis, but you do not interrupt the epi or the perineurium of the nerve, so it's not destroyed. So you get the axonal regeneration. The nerve regrows. So depending on how big the ice ball is, how long you deal with it, it's about 3 to 6 months to 9 months to a year to get better. This is just me doing a procedure on one patient in the office. The patient's not under sedation. They are under local. That's what one of the devices look like with the ultrasound. This is a non-sterile procedure in the office. Obviously, if it was preoperatively, we do it sterilely, and this patient is doing well now post-op. Another picture of the ultrasound. So you have your subcutaneous tissue whenever adipose. We have our intercostal muscles, and that little black dot on the right, that is the rib. That's where we're looking, the target over there. The big risk of the procedure is that little pink line on the bottom is the pleura. You don't want to stick a needle there because that would be a pneumothorax, and the patient would not be happy. But if you pop through those intercostal muscles and you could walk off the rib, you could easily do this procedure. This is another picture of it, and it just shows the needle popping off. The red dot is where the nerve would be. So again, it's safe, it's tolerable, and people do well. Again, the first study of it was the 60 patients. The only thing bad about the study was insufficient to assess for the power of the difference of persistent post-surgical pain. I believe the team, they're out in San Diego. One of my friends is out there. They're looking to expand that trial. The other issue with the cryo right now is that for a bilateral mastectomy, the procedure might take a half an hour to 45 minutes. So it might be beneficial to do a nerve block before to make it more tolerable, or to maybe bring the patient in at a separate date just to get reimbursed and to not delay any of the surgical procedures. We're working on this in our institution. This is what it looks like on another patient. You see the needle coming in, hitting the inferior border of the rib after I pop through the intercostal muscle. The middle and the right side of picture, you don't see the ice ball, but you see that hypoechoic, that like kind of like rounded black area underneath the needle. That's the shadow of the ice ball. So the device that I use, the ice ball is about 2.5 millimeters, which is enough to stun the intercostal nerve and give the patient pain relief.
Gary, can you go back? We're looking at the inferior edge.
Yes, I'm coming from caudal to cephalad.
So we know from putting chest tubes in that the neurovascular
bundle is there.
So do you see the artery and the vein when
this? The vein you cannot see. The vein you cannot see, the artery you see about 20% of the time. So in these cryo devices, gas is not getting injected into the body. It's forming an ice ball. So when our thoracic colleagues do the surgery, they obviously rip everything out there. These normally don't bleed if you stick it with a needle. It's fairly compressible.
And the ice doesn't affect the artery or the
vein? No. So this is the thing. The gas is not injected into the body. Everything goes back through the needle tip into the device. So you're not worried about an embolus. And then I guess the worst case, if you put the ice ball by artery, somehow miraculously got it over there, our body temperature hopes to be less than 100.4. It would probably just melt the ice ball faster. But it's that initial stun within the first 30 seconds. It helps out the pain of the nerve. This is just another picture of that, what it looks like with our cryoneurolysis probe and the vasculature. I haven't had any injuries from that. There was another study, ultrasound guided for treatment of pain after mastectomy. And this is just showing lower pain relief after the surgery, less opiates. And the cryo group is blue. The sham group is, a beige or a talc, whatever you want to call it, over there. And this is looking at opiate consumption. So after day 3, the sham group still had some opiate use and the cryo did not. And they noticed that up to 28 days, they tracked that out, which is pretty impressive because not everyone has a program like Dr. Borgen where they give no opiates for after. The next stage is what do we do for this post-mastectomy pain if we can't do all these treatments before? So we know several nerves may be damaged during breast surgeries, especially in the setting of cancer. And the perioperative cryoneurolysis of T2 to T5 of the study I just showed resulted in reduced procedural pain. This study looked at percutaneous, and we're looking to look at it under ultrasound to block the intercostal brachial nerve with cryo. And in this small cohort of patients, it decreased their pain up to 180 days. And this is in patients who already had post-mastectomy pain. This is where the intercostal brachial nerve lies. I believe it's the one area of issue with the post-mastectomy pain patients. So it's a potential source. The ICBN, the intercostal brachial nerves, arises from the lateral cutaneous branch of the intercostal nerve. It goes through the external intercostal muscles, as we remember, in the serratus anterior, and then goes to the axilla. And that's where it's vulnerable during breast surgery. So sometimes it could be ligated, stretched. We don't totally know. But when we have damage to this or people get scarring after, they can get an aroma, and that could lead to post-surgical pain. This slide just shows their study, the difference on their historical controls versus the cryo, how much decreased opiates and pain relief these patients had. And we'll be up to open after, but it wouldn't be a Sunday morning in Miami without talking about cannabis. It's legal in almost every state now. This is the next step of the, maybe another pandemic, depending on how you look at it, but it's quite legal. My kids like basketball. 3-block radius of Madison Square Garden reeks like marijuana, that you cannot get around it. I'm sure in my 5 a.m. jog this morning, people were smoking as they were living a live nightclub, but it's the most commonly abused psychotropic substance after alcohol. About 10% of the U.S. population, adult population, over 30 million report monthly use, and that number is probably more apt to go up now that it's legalized. I'm part of this ASRA Pain Medicine Consensus. We had perioperative guidelines for the anesthesiologist, but I think this is important to tell our surgical colleagues so you know what's going on with the substances and how they could affect our patients. If you just Google cannabis guidelines, ASRA, it's actually free from the journal in case you want to look at it in detail. We had 12 experts of either perioperative pain, chronic pain, acute anesthesia pain, and even a patient advocate when we made these guidelines. And a couple of questions came out of it. Should we screen preoperatively? And the answer we came, yes. Part of the American Society of Anesthesiologists guidelines is we have to ask about whatever substance patients are taking, legal or not, but we should ask all of our patients, do they smoke cannabis? How much? Do they take gummies, CBD, THC? We did not recommend against toxicology screening. And the reason we want to screen is because marijuana has been found to affect cytochrome enzymes. There are drug metabolism concerns, especially with opiates, the CYP450, like everything else. So it could affect, if you're giving opiates after, it could affect our anesthetics. And we want to ask if they're a high-dose user or a low-dose user. So high doses, what's significant usage? If it's 1.5 grams inhaled cannabis a day, 20 milligrams THC oil, 300 milligrams of CBD oil, or unknown use, 2 joints a day or anything else. Most people who use it a lot could tell you how much they use and why it's as important, because it could affect the perioperative period. You can get tachycardia, palpitations, you could act like a COPD-er, and you could get slow reaction time. So again, 3 in 10 people who use marijuana have marijuana use disorder or cannabis use disorder. It directly affects the cardiovascular system, the brain, the respiratory system. It could affect decision making. And we know elevated heart rate could last up to 90 minutes after the onset of marijuana inhalation. So if they're smoking and going into the OR, you probably want to hold breath. Young patients had an increased risk of arrhythmias, PVCs, AFibs, aflutter, slight increased risk of myocardial infarction, 5-fold increase within the first hour of use. So something important for surgery. So if someone comes in and they smoke within 2 hours of surgery, we don't recommend canceling. Surgeons hate the C word, anesthesiologists hate the C word. We like to say postpone just for safety. So we recommend delaying the case 2 hours if they're acutely inhaled marijuana, at least smoking. They should be counseled on the dangers of it. And we could not recommend routine tapering of marijuana before. This is with the postponed surgeries. And the main reason we want to postpone it into 2 hours beforehand is there's an increased risk of heart, increased rate of heart rate, increased blood pressure, higher risk of stroke, MI, anywhere from 60 to 90 minutes. So if we wait 2 hours, we're out of that zone. It could have effects on airway resistance, which could affect our anesthesiologists. And we know that it's safe, at least orally. So should we stop at pre-op? It depends what they're taking. Smoking, maybe yes. If it's taking oral, do not discontinue. People use it for chemo-induced nausea and vomiting, anorexia. If you have any Canadian patients, they might take it. It's legal over there in forms. or they have these weird neurologic disease, seizure disorders, patients might be taking it. You do not want to stop for that. GI, it could be acute antiemetic effects, and you can get a hyperemesis syndrome. They're not at risk of aspiration, but high-dose cannabis use, so if they're smoking 2 to 3 joints a day, they're not going to lose weight like the Wegovy patients or the GLP-1 agonists, but it does show their it slows their gastric empty at times. So slightly higher risk of aspiration for the case. So now post-op, multimodal analgesia, which we spoke about, nerve blocks from Dr. Borgen's team, nerve blocks from my team, cryo, acetaminophen. You want to attack these people in any way and not give them opiates. You have to monitor them for withdrawal because they could withdraw pretty severely. They're not going to die like a benzo, but they could get pretty sick and prolong their hospitalization. If they are withdrawing, drobanolol, most hospitals have 2.5 milligrams for the treatment of that. And I can't, this is why we want to delay cases who people use a lot and they high or coming in smoking acutely going into the operating room. 2 times risk higher of MI, up to 5 times within 1 hour of surgery, 3 risk of higher risk of stroke or TIA in weekly users, and a higher risk of DVT, CVA, also postoperative hypotension. So these are the risks over here, which is why you want to ask your patients, and it's very, very simple. Do you use any cannabis products? How often? Most people are pretty easily to admit that now. The withdrawal symptom is the highest risk patients, and they just have to really be counseled. So it's, again, it's uncomfortable, but it's not going to kill them, and it happens in about 8 to 12% of patients. It could occur as early as 24 hours, so unfortunately, if you do same-day surgery, which you do a lot, they're going to go home that same day and probably smoke again, but it could last up to a month. So you want to be careful about that, and again, it's from the high THC uses. So if they're taking CBD oils or pills, probably not going to happen. It's people who take high THC is going to be the highest risk for this. And then there's no guidance so much on post-op opiate prescriptions with cannabis. There's no established guidance. It shows that it maybe could reduce opiate-related harm. You might be able to withdraw people off opiates, but you just want to adjust your dose if you're going to prescribe them. Thankfully, we spoke about today, we have a lot of different treatments between our liposome bupivacaine, our cryo, our multimodal, to not have any of these opiates after the fact, but you just want to be careful. And if you are going to prescribe them, you might want to adjust the dose. So thank you for your time. I appreciate everything.
So we will be up here if you have questions. From my perspective, the two greatest impacts on the success of opioid minimization, and we've now done probably well over 3,000 breast conservation cases at Maimonides without a single MME, without a single milligram of opioids. So the two things that matter are setting expectations. My mom had surgery, and she complained of pain for 4 weeks. We are dedicated to you not having pain. We're dedicated to you not needing opioids. And reinforcing that message, as Josh Feinberg said, is 50% of the battle. I can't go home without an opioid. I'm just nervous. I'm going to need opioids. So setting that expectation. The second thing that has revolutionized this is long-acting liposomal bupivacaine. It makes a difference. I always hear colleagues say, well, it didn't work in my hands. Well, it's very viscous. It has to be injected in a very precise way so that you don't miss a spot. I'm a big fisherman, and we like to say that if you lose a fish, it's because there's a jerk on the end of the line. And it could be the problem is not the Exparel. It could be the other end of the line. So I want to, we're going to go to our post-session survey. Let's run through these questions again. Simple mastectomy has a higher rate than which of the following? Please choose now. I'm feeling good about this one, Steve. Ms. Kroll? Okay. Next question. The Non-Opioids Prevention, the No Pain Act, went into effect. All outpatient surgical settings, inpatient settings, or all settings, please choose now. That's great. Okay, next question, please. How long does it last? How long does cryoneurolysis last? 1, 6, 12, or 24 months? Please choose now. Okay, next. 64-year-old presenting for mastectomy with immediate breast reconstruction. She has a history of poor pain control. Which of the following ERAS Society recommended intraoperative analgesics would be the best option for this patient? Liposome bupivacaine, oxycodone, pregaba, or sufentanil? Please choose now. That's great. And then finally, we have two more. Suzetrigine is a new class. How does it work? Sodium channels centrally, sodium channels peripherally, or potassium channels in those two locations. Please choose your best answer. That is the correct answer. And then finally, how confident are you to change your practice with regard to post-surgical and non-opioid pain medicine management from number 1, not at all, to 7? Please choose now. Let's scroll down. Wow. A little bit further. There we go. All right. I want to thank Pacira Pharmaceuticals for two things, sponsoring this session, but more importantly, helping us tackle back home in Brooklyn and frankly around the world this opioid problem. Secondly, I want to thank you for getting up at a really early time with daylight savings time. So we're grateful that you're here. Please help yourselves to breakfast. We're going to start the morning session at 8:45. Please join me in thanking our panel. We'll see you in about 15 minutes.